Stephen Pritchard, today we're going to be talking about ethical investing.
Yeah, we've got Jack Lowenstein along to talk to us about ethical investment. Jack's kind of history is with Hannah Hall, which was one of the very early ethical investors in Australia. So he kind of left that some time ago and went up and set up a new firm, and they concentrate on ethical investing. And we had him on a few months ago, and we're going to expand on the different types of ethical investing, because ethical investing apparently means different things to different people.
That's always good to get it.
Which is interesting.
Interesting. It is.
Ethical investment, you know, some people think things are ethical and others...
Others don't. And we'll get Jack Lowenstein's view on that a little later on in the program. And as well as that, we'll have our market update and currencies and commodities. What are we up to with gold, for example?
Gold was up $13.12 an ounce for the week to $1,831.79. So gold was up.
Mm-hmm. The copper price. Jewelry.
Yes, you can melt down your jewelry, Jane. Look at all those gold bangles you've got on there.
Yes.
And copper was down $316.50 a tonne to $8,798. And the tin price was down $125 a tonne to $27,872. And the oil price was down $2.62 to $99.75 a barrel.
Now, I've given up feeling excited when I hear that.
Because the retail price has gone up. And then the currencies, the Australian dollar was down marginally to 69.94 cents last night, so it's just below the 70 cents again. So that makes your offshore assets worth more, your international investments, and more expensive to go overseas.
Okay.
Yes, there seems to be a few people going to Europe next week, of which I'm not one. And the Great British Pound, we were up slightly against the Great British Pound to 53.75, but, you know, we're a very 100th of a cent there difference. And against the New Zealand dollar, we were up 0.3% to $1.06, and against the euro, we're pretty much steady at 62.46 euro cents. So not really a great change in currencies there. Although the Australian dollar's tending to, you know, it's drifted down almost 2 cents in the last 6 weeks. It's drifting down. The All Ordinaries Index was down 78.3 on the week to 6,351. Markets are always don't like uncertainty. We've got the election coming up, so you'll probably find that after the election, the markets tend to go up, no matter which party's elected, because some of the uncertainties left the market. The S&P 500 was down 38.1 to 2,879. The UK FTSE was down 80.3 to 7,271. And the Nikkei was down 656, because I've got a new emperor over there, 21,602.
So there's a little bit of uncertainty there.
Were closed for 10 days or something. The whole of Japan basically shut down for 10 days.
Okay, as a kind of celebration of
celebration, and apparently they only... It was a big thing in Japan, because apparently most people are lucky to get 2 weeks holiday anyhow. And the whole country shuts down for 10 days.
Yes, okay.
Yeah, so that was all something interesting to learn.
Yeah, what about some stocks?
Some stocks. BHP was up 16 cents on the week to $37.18. CBA was down 12 cents to $74.74. NIB was up 3 cents to $5.80. I had a look at NIB the other day. I'm almost, if you held your NIB shares, it's almost paying half my health insurance premium now.
Oh, really?
So NIB has been a very good performer for people who held their shares. And Telstra was down 7 cents to $3.29. The fuel price, as we said earlier, Newcastle was up 9 cents a litre this week to $1.50.8. And Sydney was down 5 cents to $1.44.4. So we've almost reversed the positions from last week. And the diesel fuel price was $1.51.3 in Newcastle and $1.48.2 in Sydney. So not much change there.
Okay. So in just a moment, we will come back with our market update, taking a look at some of the stocks and shares and the companies in the stock market, seeing how they're faring. To NUR FM, 24 past 12. This is Thursday Finance and Stephen Pritchard time. We had a look at some of the things that are happening in the market at the moment. Now, TPG and Vodafone were proposing to merge.
Yes, TPG and Vodafone were proposing merge. The principal reason was they wanted to build a third competing cellular telephone network around the Australian 5G. Now, as some people might know, Vodafone's already got a limited cellular telephone network, and TPG's talked about building a new cellular telephone network. And so TPG worked out it was going to cost too much money, basically, and decided to merge with Vodafone. The ACCC knocked back the proposed merger and seemed to think that TPG's going to build a fourth mobile telephone network, but TPG said no, it's not going to happen. And the interesting thing was the TPG, the ACCC released this announcement at midday yesterday when both stocks were trading, and TPG promptly fell, of course. The ACCC is now saying that, you know, the announcement shouldn't have been released during market hours. It was supposed to go out at 12 midnight tonight or something, and someone's obviously set the fax machine or whatever they use, email, delayed release time, got their AMs and their PMs mixed up. So the ACCC is having an investigation as to how they sent out the announcement. So it doesn't look like Australia's going to have a fourth mobile telephone network. Mm-hmm. And it remains to be seen, I think, about what Vodafone does about the third one. So we might even end up with two instead of three.
So at that stage, it's Telstra and Optus.
Yeah, because Vodafone's not making any money anyhow. So
okay.
Yes.
All right. So in the meantime, let's go green.
Yeah, so there's been this takeover bid, it must have been announced last September, October last year, for Grain Corporation. And Grain Corp owns the grain silos you see around the countryside, amongst other assets. They've sold a lot of their other assets, and long-term asset partners have said they've discovered issues during their due diligence process and they've decided not to bid for Grain Corp. So that takeover bid's now off the table. The other takeover bid that is progressing, it's a vote sometime in the next week or so, is Healthscope shares. Now, Healthscope's been as a takeover bid for an offshore entity. The shareholders' scheme meeting's coming up. The share price is trading almost to the bid price. So if you've got some Healthscope shares, there's always the risk that the shareholders will vote the thing down. And there's also a risk about regulatory approvals along the line. So, you know, you might consider thinking about selling those shares if you've got Healthscope shares and, you know, trading off the risk for the 1 or 2 cents share difference that you're... Because there's no doubt if the takeover offer gets voted down, the share's price will fall.
Okay.
And down to more concern about bonuses at Caltex. Caltex share price is about the lowest it is in 4 years. The board's put up that they want to award the CEO some performance rights, and the Australian Shareholders Association has come out and recommend that people vote against it, because all we're really doing is we're going to give the CEO more money for the job he's supposed to be doing anyhow, and the shares haven't performed particularly well. So it's interesting that shareholders are becoming, and the ASA particularly so, are becoming more proactive and putting out, particularly against high levels of salary and incentives and bonuses. I mean,
so this is happening in more companies.
It's more happening in more companies. Yeah. You know, you saw the National Bank, you saw Westpac. People are, you know, these bonuses are getting huge, and the companies are only just producing ordinary results. So they're really getting bonuses for jobs they should have been doing anyhow. Yeah. So shareholders seem to be waking up to that. So that's good. It won't do any harm there.
And for years, companies have been saying, "Come along, be part of your company."
Well, you should
exercise your governance.
You should exercise
the governance you have. Starting to have some.
It's something to have some, and you need to when your proxy votes come out. You know, you need to have at least look, and you know, some of the things we kind of look at generally is do the directors have any shares in the company? And, you know, my kind of feeling, if the directors have been there for a while and they don't have any shares in the company, they've obviously got no faith in their own performance, so why should you vote for them? I mean, there's one large property company that none of the directors had any shareholding in, and that was put to me, that's to avoid conflict of interest, and that's just complete nonsense.
Mm.
Yeah, the best way to align the director's interest and the shareholder's interest is that the directors have
a shareholding
and a reasonable shareholding.
Yes.
If you go back in history, it was, as usual, you used to have a director's qualification become a director of a company. So that was known in the 1860s. So, yeah, one thing to look for, the remuneration of directors, the director's history, do they have a reasonable shareholding in the company, how long they've been on the board. If someone's been on the board 3 months, it's not unreasonable for them to have no shares. But if someone's been on the board for 5 years and they've got no shares, you've got to ask what they're actually doing there.
Mm. Okay, so there's a responsibility involved.
Yeah, there's a responsibility
in
there's promoting.
Shares.
Yeah, you need to have a look at it and tick all the boxes in whatever order. Have a think about it. And Landmark White's been interesting. Landmark White's a valuation company that does a lot of valuations for financial institutions around the country, property valuations. Someone hacked into their computer system a few months ago and copied or stole various bits of data on property valuations, and as a result, a number of their clients suspended dealing with Landmark White. And then the shares were suspended. They've supposedly patched up their IT systems and increased security. And some of the businesses come back, but Landmark White shares returned to trading yesterday and promptly dropped 47%.
No, that's
so, you know, this security of IT systems becoming more and more critical, and it's becoming harder and harder to implement. Because
the hackers keep getting clever,
and they send you these fake emails, and, now the fake emails are getting so good, it's very difficult to tell which are the real ones and which are the fake ones.
Thursday Finance on 2NURFM and our market update, what's happening with the stocks and shares around the place on the market, and ASL, Brisbane based. What does ASL stand for, Stephen?
I don't actually know what it stands for. It used to be called Campbell Brothers before it changed its name to ASL. So it's in there. It has these laboratories for testing various things. So I assume the L stands for laboratories. And I don't know what the ASL stands for. Anyhow, so it's a company that tests various things in mining and whatever you need testing in a laboratory. And they had three laboratories in China, which they've sold for $82 million. And they're saying that they're exiting the Chinese market because of continual rule changes and it's all too hard, basically.
Mm.
Yeah. So, and then NAB's in the news again. Apparently when they sold Clydesdale Bank, which was the UK subsidiary, the regulator over there asked them for some guarantee in respect of problems of various financial products they'd sold.
This is in the UK.
In the UK. And now apparently there's a number of court cases occurring in the UK, and Clydesdale Bank might have to pay close to $1 billion in damages, and under the guarantee amount, that's all going to come back to the NAB. So there could be further bad news coming down the path for NAB shareholders. And I suppose good news for Automotive Holdings shareholders. AP Eagers has increased their takeover offer for Automotive Holdings from 143.8 Automotive Holdings shares to 143.6, and the board of Automotive Holdings is now recommending the offer. So the big car dealers in Newcastle will only be owned by one.
That's going ahead anyway, it seems.
Yeah, it's going ahead, yes.
Mm, okay. Well, that's our market update. And franking credits are sort of on the, they're a hot topic at the moment. Everybody's talking about franking credits, and even in last night's third and final leaders debate, it was a hot topic. Now, to take a look at that, expand on what they are and how they may or may not affect you, next week on Thursday Finance, we'll have Dr. Michael Seamer, who's head lecturer in taxation at the University of Newcastle, and he'll give you an all-round view of franking credits. And you are FM 21 to 1, and on Thursday, Finance, it's time to take a look at ethical investing. I should say, Stephen, it's actually a second look at ethical investing on this program.
Yeah, we had a introductory look a couple of months ago with Jack Lowenstein, one of Australia's leading ethical investors, and I thought we'd just continue on from where we were last time, Jack.
Sounds good.
So we just had a, we went over last time, we had a three-step approach to ethical investing as respect for the client's values and back the improvers and seek out the worst to short sell.
Exactly. So should I give you a quick refresh on
yes,
that one?
Yes.
So basically, our respect, when we say respect to our client's values, we mean avoiding, we don't invest in stocks that are involved in gambling, tobacco, environmental destruction, and so on. That's the respect the values bit.
Yep.
In terms of back the improvers, we don't say that perfect is best. We say the best that from an investment return perspective in this context, often the best returns come from finding something that's not perfect, but has got a commitment to getting better, and that gets rewarded in both company performance and share price.
Yes.
And lastly, seek out the worst to short. If we can find a company where we think there are essentially things that show the company is making profits it doesn't deserve, for example, through getting away with pollution that it won't be allowed to do in the future, that's a good opportunity for us to short.
Okay, so there's a whole lot of list of those things, so we haven't got really time to go through that. And so then we're going to talk about how the kind of screening process works.
Yep. So, I mean, I suppose I've said what we won't invest in, and so the question then arises, how much impact does it have on our investment universe?
Yes.
Our total investment universe, which we define as all companies in the world that listed companies have a market cap of more than $400 million
mm-hmm.
and a minimum daily turnover of more than $3 million, that brings us down to about 9,000 stocks, which is still a huge number, as you can imagine. And if we then strip out the stocks we can't invest in, we've still got about 8,500 left. So the impact on our investable universe is actually very small.
Mm-hmm. So there's about 70,000 listed stocks in the world, is that right? That's a lot.
Yep, that's about right, yeah.
Must have a huge team of people reading the annual reports though, Jack.
No, we don't bother to read all of them. We just obviously, we like everybody else in this industry, we screen for the stuff we think looks interesting, both long and short, using these things called computers that are making a big difference to investments since I started. And that helps us get the 8,000 typically down to about 100 stocks we're interested in, long and short, that we keep an eye on.
Okay, so is there any big screens? Like, do you exclude particular countries, for example?
No, we don't exclude countries on principle. There are some countries that I think are very difficult for us to invest in because it's so hard to get comfort about governance issues in particular. So Russia is a classic example there. I mean, I've never invested in Russia, and I'd be pretty nervous about doing it. And there are a few other places where I feel a bit similar to that. But we're very keen to invest in places like India, China, and so on, where generally the governance trends are improving, as is the focus on environmental issues. So we're not scared about investing in emerging markets, for example, and there's no blanket exclusion in principle by country.
So I mean, I remember at one stage you invested in some of the banks in India, and I thought that was interesting. And now you seem to be investing in the power grid, which is interesting because I would have thought a lot of that power grid was coal powered in India. So how does all that, or is this an improving stock? How does that all work?
Okay, well, obviously, power grid is not a generator, so it doesn't fail our negative screen.
Yep.
It doesn't. All it does is move power from point A to point B.
Yep.
Now, Yeah, you know, we have had questions asked us, but, you know, aren't you being, you know, cheating a bit because, it's, you know, they're still moving thermal power, and we recognise that. But I think the key point we see is at the kind of the improving theme point is that a huge amount of the growth in Indian power generation is coming from wind and solar. Mm-hmm. And without a strong grid company, you cannot, as we know in Australia, you cannot achieve that transition. So we see power grid as a vital piece of the infrastructure in India that's allowing the switch from coal-based power to wind and solar. And indeed, if from a business point of view, some of the most important growth elements to the power grid story are about building what they call the Green Energy Corridor, mm-hmm. which is basically a new grid that goes out to parts of India where there's not a lot of population but a lot of sun and wind, and bringing that power into the more populated areas where there obviously is a great need for it. Similarly, Power Grid is the key player in the electrification of the Indian railway system. Now, only about half of India's railway system, which is the second biggest in the world, used to be the biggest, and now the second biggest, is actually runs on electricity. Half of it is still running on diesel. Mm-hmm. So, and a key government objective is to get that diesel out of the system and both expand the rail network and move to full electrification. And Power Grid is a vital part in that process. We also expect Power Grid to be a key player in building what's called grid-level storage, which is a vital tool if you want to have fast charging for electric vehicles. But that's a way down the track.
Okay. And, of course, one of the things I would have thought, would you, take into account the fact that this power grid is enabling the Indian living standard to be upgraded as well?
Absolutely. I mean, there's a key policy, which is to get power for all in India. As of about 2 years ago, there were still about 5,000 villages in India that had no power, no connection to power at all. Now, that is the responsibility of the state. So Power Grid is a national grid company. So think about it as a company that would transfer power from WA to New South Wales. Not that actually happens, but, you know, in principle, that's the kind of thing they do. And they deliver the power into the state grids. Mm-hmm. Remember, in India, the average state is about four times as big as Australia in terms of population. But what's happening? Another thing that's happening there is that Power Grid, because it's a very strong and well-managed company, and the state grids are quite weak, is doing more and more work now in intrastate. A grid development, helping that process of getting power to all, which is a critical element to improving living standards at a very basic level. Let me give you an example. I mean, one of the worst things for a home or for poor people is to be burning wood.
Yep.
Or even kerosene.
Kerosene.
Because it's very bad for health. So if you can get people off those fuel sources onto gas, dare I say it, but more encouraging electricity, you've made a huge difference to life. So we do think this is it's part of what we call a positive screen, trying to make the world a better place.
We might just take a break.
And by the way, I should say, trading on about 9x PE with huge growth in cash flows. So we're very excited about it.
We might just take a break after that investment tip and come back in a minute.
Yeah, thanks, Jake. It's actually really interesting looking at the principles behind ethical investing with Jack Lowenstein. Thursday Finance on 2NURFM. It's 10 to 1. And we're taking a look at ethical investing with Jack Lowenstein, who's Managing Director of Morphic Asset Management Limited. Over to you, Stephen Pritchard.
So one of the issues, I suppose, about people concerned about investing in countries such as India is what's the sovereign risk or the risk that you can actually, the state's not going to confiscate all your money because there's a change in government or something.
Yeah, look, I think I've got to say India. I've been going to India for nearly 40 years, and my parents tell me I was conceived there, so and I believe them. So I do know India pretty well. I'm sure many of your listeners have been there as well. It's a chaotic, messy place. But there's been absolutely no history of anybody expropriating assets from foreigners, certainly in the last 30 years. I think probably even going back further than that. So I think that's a low risk. The big risk at the moment is that while we're all focused on the election here, roughly the same time as an election going on in India, it's a little bit different there because the country's so big, they actually held the election over about a three-week period. I've invested, this is my third election I'm investing through, actually, I guess you could say the fourth. And one thing I've learned is that there's a lot of fear before elections, and then there's typically you get a pretty good return after the election. So if I look at the election, they have elections on a five-year cycle. It's traditionally you want to be invested in the market before the election. Now, the thing that everybody's worried about this time is that 15 years ago, there were the BJP, which is the current slightly, but came up as a Liberal Party, some difference, but very similar. They're in power in India. They in 2004, the economy was booming, at least it looked like it was, and they looked like they're heading for to be returned to power, and everybody was very excited, and there was a shock defeat.
Oh.
And the election got the market got smashed. People are nervous about that happening again. We think it's unlikely. We're not absolutely sure, but that's why we're maintaining exposure through the cycle.
Right. So you've actually owned some of the power grid and other Indian stocks.
Yeah. Correct.
Okay. So when is the election?
The election it's so complicated. Basically, it takes place over about 3 weeks. I think it's finishing on the 18th, if I'm right. I think it's roughly the same. It's the 18th of Saturday, obviously. I think it's...
So it's already started, like, at the end of April.
Yeah. They have electronic voting machines. And they move them around the country and vote in a series of what they call phases.
Oh,
so they're voting now. Now, the interesting thing about India is it's so big and so diverse, you can't rely on opinion polls. You can't get a big enough sample. The election results have been announced on the 23rd. I was wrong, sorry. The only way to really have a good feel of what's going to happen is actually the betting markets. And the betting markets in India are, totally illegal and
yes.
Really active. They're all saying that the BJP government will get back in, that's Prime Minister Modi, with a slightly reduced majority. If that's the case, we think the market will go up a lot on that confirmation because there's still some fear. A bit like Australia, by the way, the betting markets here are very good at predicting. Unfortunately, I think they're predicting 70-30 that Labour will win.
Well, I don't know. We want to get into that at the moment. So a few years ago, like 1 or 2 years ago, I saw these pictures of all these people lined up in India with all these 1,000 rupee notes, I think, or something, and the government had cancelled all them. What was behind that?
Okay, that was very interesting. So that was basically a crackdown on corruption,
mm-hmm.
and. I don't think it was totally successful, but basically the idea was if you've got people used to have, $1 million in cash at home, very rich people operating in slightly sleazy businesses, particularly real estate, and the idea was that they limited. They said everybody can go to the bank and exchange. I think it was about a couple of $1,000 worth of banknotes for new banknotes, but the rest of you, sorry. You obviously got the money. The money's obviously dirty. We're going to basically confiscate it. It didn't work very well for a whole bunch of reasons, and it caused quite a lot of dislocation to the economy. But what was very interesting about it was the poor, who were inconvenienced, found that they rather enjoyed the pain of the rich.
Mm-hmm.
And the rich got out of it, by the way. So, for example, if you were a servant working for a rich Indian family, they just came to you and they said to you, we're going to pay you in advance for a year. Here's your your $2,000 that we pay you a year, and go off the bank and change it. So they, and that's your pay for the year. So that's how the rich got around it.
So it didn't work. So we're just going to have to. We're running out of time here. So what else do we need to know about India?
Look, I think India's been the most rewarding developing market in the world for a long period for foreign investors. It goes up and down. It's got volatility. But the thing I like about it is, and this is going to sound bizarre, capital is scarce, therefore it doesn't get wasted. Therefore, share market investors do well.
Okay. Well, thanks for that, Jack. And probably talk to you in a few months again.
Thank you very much, Jack Lowenstein. And that's Thursday Finance for today.
Thanks for listening to this podcast from 2NURFM at the University of Newcastle. Topics range from gardening to health, well-being, pet care, finance, business, and travel. You'll find them all at 2NURFM.com.